Hello, it's Friday, 8th of January, 2021. Happy New Year. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson.
Yeah, Happy New Year. I'm Gary Bowerman from Check In Asia.
So it's time to kickstart 2021, and let's hope it's much better year than 2020.
Absolutely. And to get the show rolling, we've created a 21-point travel wish list for 2021. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. Well, I'm really glad to see the back of 2020. But what is 2021 going to deliver? We are full of anticipation and a little bit of trepidation as well. Will vaccines really be the magic bullet?
Yeah, we've got time to find out, I guess. We decided to kick off this year by discussing our hopes for travel and tourism in Southeast Asia and beyond throughout the year. Hannah and I have brainstormed a 21 for 2021 wish list, which we'll discuss in two parts. We'll run down from 1 to 11 in this show, and then from 12 to 21 in part two. So let's get started, Hannah. And I have to say, that first pick, number one, that looks familiar.
This was one of our wishes for 20 for the 2020s. No more target setting. And I think it rings even more true, even truer than it was in 2020. We have seen throughout 2020 so many tourism boards, airlines, everybody basically setting targets for tourists and then falling short of those, and then resetting new targets and then falling short. And we're seeing all kinds of forecasts for, you know, 2021, 2022 to 2025. And at this point, people need to give up.
Well, it's pretty much down to guesstimation. I mean, this year we've had such a data deficit. I mean, the year started off quite well in some of the countries in our region. You know, countries like Vietnam had a really good January. I think Singapore Changi Airport was up 5% year on year in January alone. So the year got off to a good start, and everybody was, you know, really hopeful that there would be these record volume targets would be reached again this year. And then obviously we know what happened. But yeah, I agree with you. You know, setting targets is just a little bit 2017, isn't it, really? Everything has changed. The whole focus of the way tourism is gonna roll out has changed. And it just seems like volume setting now, I mean, the numbers that you would be setting are going to be so way down on what you had before. You know, I think marketing should actually just focus on differentiating destinations rather than just trying to set arbitrary targets. But having said that, we know what will happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can understand it to some extent. They want to set a target so that they can base their forecasts and base their budgets and everything else around it. So you can understand that. But it's just, you know, putting a finger up to the wind right now, isn't it?
Well, it really is, because there is just such of a lack of data really to use as a benchmark, which brings us, Hannah, onto point number two.
It does. That's pretty neat. So this is going to be an interesting conundrum, actually, that everybody is going to face this year. And we've put using 2019 as a, or not using 2019 as a benchmark for tourism numbers. But what do you use as a benchmark, right? Can you use 2020 as a benchmark for 2021? Can you use 2019? Should we go back 10 years? Should we just say there's no benchmarking?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point, because if you look across, we've said this a few times on the pod, haven't you, that over since 2020, you know, we've seen this upward growth across Asia Pacific, particularly in Southeast Asia over the last 5 years. You know, tourism and travel of all kinds really has taken off. And those numbers in many countries, we were seeing record numbers. Airlines were recording record numbers. You know, there were more and more hotels being open because there were record numbers. But it isn't going to go back to that. And, you know, whether it's going to go back to that ever again, it isn't really the issue. It's how do we actually start moving from what really is point zero right now? You know, there's just so little happening. I think that's going to be a big question, is how, because you made a very good point there, Hannah, but, you know, people have to set budgets, whether that's tourism boards, whether that's travel companies, whether that's airlines, and they've really got to start looking ahead and growing at whenever that happens, whether that's later in the year or not. And you usually do that based on financial targets and statistical targets. But setting those, as we mentioned just a minute ago, is kind of guesswork right now.
Yeah, I mean, and when you're using 2020 as a benchmark for your 2021 numbers, anything is going to be 100% growth, 120% growth. It's not really, you know, if you go from 0 to 1,000 tourists, it's not really something to shout about. But if you're looking at kind of percentage growth, it's going to be insane. It's tricky. It's very tricky.
It is. And particularly as well as we don't know at the moment the speed and the differentiated speeds of vaccine rollouts. So, you know, the demand and the supply side is just so unpredictable right now. We simply just don't know. Nobody knows. You know, I noticed this week that Qantas has said that it's going to start selling international flight tickets from July this year. But, you know, that's 7 months down the road. So it's anybody's guess, right?
Yeah. What's number three then, Gary?
Number three is, so let's look back to look forward in a way. So don't write off 2020 totally. There must be some positives to build upon. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously 2020 has been a complete disaster for the tourism industry, but there have still been upsides. You know, I think people have got more innovative. I think domestic tourism has got a bit more interesting, has had more of the limelight. And that's definitely something that, you know, we should appreciate and we should applaud and we should, you know, really admire these innovative kind of tourism stakeholders who are trying to make the best of it. So there is definitely some positives, even though the negatives outweigh it. What do you think?
I think you're right that really the positive to look at is how domestic tourism changed and how travellers themselves may have changed, you know, reflective and how we're going to look forward to travel in future. You know, for the near future, even when travel restarts again, it's unlikely that we'll be traveling as regularly or as frequently as we did before. So there is every chance that those holidays will be a bit more meaningful. We'll probably look at some of the experiences that we had traveling domestically this year and how we can translate that into the international sphere. Brands, tourism companies are going to have to take that on board. They're going to have to look a lot more closely at how people traveled this year within their own countries. They've not done that before very much. And I think that's really important. And I've been banging on for years. I do a lot of work in the Chinese travel sphere. And I've been saying since about 2010, that you really need to look at the consumer trends, the travel trends, all sorts of different technology trends within China, because Chinese travelers take those expectations with them on the road. And, you know, Chinese consumers particularly are highly indulged at home. You know, everything is going their way or it has done up until 2020. And they expect the same thing when they're traveling overseas. So, you know, we've all got used this year to shopping from home. We've all got used to e-commerce, to digital payments. There's lots of things. There's been, as you said, Hannah, there's been quite a lot of innovation in products, in technology. And some of that is going to roll out into the travel sphere next year. And, you know, I kind of wonder at the moment from what I'm seeing in and around the travel sector, where it's almost looking as though people want to restart from scratch as where it was before. But, you know, a lot has changed. The whole technology landscape has really changed over the last year. So I think there are a lot of positives in terms of the way we're going to have to look at just commerce, the way that people trade, the way that people buy things, the way that people browse and peruse things and research for information. Because I think a lot of that has changed and it's certainly speeded up as well. So I think there are a lot of positives that we take into the future. And these things were probably going to happen anyway. They've just sort of happened at an accelerated pace simply because, you know, we had our freedom, we had our travel liberties taken away and we couldn't actually travel overseas. So, yeah, I think technology is going to play a much stronger part than it did before.
Yeah, agreed. So number four on our wish list is a little bit controversial, I suppose. And this is one of your picks, Gary. Do travellers need centralised tourism boards anymore? Is there any point in them? So explain, Gary.
This is another trend that I think was developing over recent years, is what is the role of a national tourism board anymore? We got used to, over the years, you know, have central tourism boards that promote the country under a single tagline. They have these quite expansive websites, but a lot of the content that they churn out is, in modern vernacular, the modern technological vernacular, is quite dated, especially when you compare it to consumer brands or luxury brands in particular. Mm. You know, the way that they market and use videography is completely different to travel brands. Have tourism boards caught up over this year? I'm not seeing any evidence of that yet. But I read an interesting article in Travel Weekly Asia a couple of days ago, which was written by the chairman of Myanmar Tourism. And that was really looking at how you can devolve and decentralize tourism decision-making down into the regions. I think in Myanmar, there's 14 different states, and they've given a lot more autonomy to the states, not in terms of budget, because they're set centrally, but in terms of how they use their resources, how they promote sort of remote and undiscovered areas. Because obviously, if you're in, you know, regional governments know their own terrain much, much better. They know their own people much, much better. There is a lot, you can be much more efficient in the way that you promote your destinations rather than doing it from the center. And the other thing that I've sort of picked up on this year, I was on a seminar with COTRI, the Chinese Outbound Tourism Research Institute. And, you know, it came across there that Chinese travelers in particular tend to look at the content that's pumped out by tourism boards as propaganda. They don't really believe much of it. They like to do their own research, and they're much more amenable to going direct to source, to finding out the really good experiences that they can find from the experience providers themselves, kind of cutting out the middleman. I think that's quite interesting, because a lot of what we've seen in all spheres this last year has been about cutting out the middleman. You know, we do a lot more e-commerce now, where we don't go into the shops, we buy it direct. Those kinds of things, you know, there is a move towards doing it yourself, and tourism is certainly no exception. And if people are looking for more meaningful and more perhaps remote experiences, are central tourism boards kind of set up to do that kind of thing? I mean, they're not really, are they?
No, that's interesting what you're saying. And I think that we've seen that even here in Malaysia, where the tourism minister said she was going off on a tour around Malaysia to discover the sites, right, to discover what they should be promoting. And you kind of thought, hang on a minute, surely somebody in the state already knows what there's worth promoting in the state. So, yeah, there's definitely, I think, a disconnect sometimes between the centralized tourism board and then on the grounds tourism. So,
yeah, well, I think Malaysia is a very good point, because if you look at Penang, for example, perhaps Sarawak and Sabah as well, those regional tourism boards are actually very good. I think they're excellent. Penang in particular is really, really the most innovative in the country, I would say. And, you know, we see them at ITB Asia, don't we? They have their own stand, you know, they have their own setup. They do it very, very well. You know, I just think it should be a little bit more regionalized. I think this central focus is sort of, like we said before, is really kind of about setting benchmarks, you know, setting these kind of volumes. But the actual better marketing has got to be devolved, I would think.
So from devolved to more joined up, which is our number five, we in 2021, we would love to see more joined up communication across governments. And this is a particular bugbear of mine, really. I'll give another Malaysian example just from last week, where you had on the one hand the tourism minister saying that Malaysia is looking at opening up travel bubbles with green zone countries. And then the next day you had the COVID-19 task force kind of head saying this is not the time to open up travel bubbles. And this kind of disconnect between the different departments just doesn't help. We've said this before in the pod, it doesn't help tourism stakeholders to plan for the future. It just makes for a really, really confusing picture for consumers and for the industry as well. So I would really love to see in 2021 the government finally getting their act together and all singing from the same hymn sheet, you know, all saying the same thing, giving the same message.
Well, 100%. And I think also the problem we tend to see is that a lot of that information just gets filtered through the media. So you see the same reports in several different newspapers publishing almost exactly the same thing. And as you said there, you know, that article that was looking at Malaysia setting up travel bubbles, you looked at the countries that they were talking about, and one of them was Japan, which I think the day before had actually announced that it was going to stop its go-to travel, domestic travel program, but simply because of the outbreak there, which has got much, much worse, and they've announced a state of emergency. So, you know, Japan wasn't even on the radar. That just seemed illogical. I don't quite understand, like you said, that lack of joined up thinking.
Let's hope 2021 will be better, but I have my reservations.
I think you're right. And I think, you know, going back to what we've said in the past two or three points there about governments, you know, I think governments are actually going to take a stronger role, because there is going to be huge competition between destinations to attract tourists the back end of this year or whenever people can travel again. So, again, I guess that leads us into point six, Hannah, which is we would like to see destinations compete on differentiation, not on price slashing. What do you think about that?
Yes. I mean, we have seen in 2020 lots of, I mean, in not just destinations, but we've seen, I guess, in general, prices dropping, you know, for luxury hotels or for tours or whatever it is. We've seen prices going really, really low. But for a destination to start promoting themselves, you know, as being the cheapest is probably not the greatest option. And they really need to, like you say, differentiate themselves. What makes it special? What makes it unique? And probably other than it just being safer than another destination. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what we saw before, I guess we'll come back. You know, there will be focus on culture and heritage and dining and landscapes, but it would be nice to see a bit of a bigger focus on sustainable tourism, perhaps. You know, upgrade, upcycle products that countries can make and sell, agritourism, perhaps, you know, stuff that gets you out into the fresh air, soft adventure, those kinds of things. It'd be nice to see a little bit more. And then I guess there's the other issue of, well, it would be nice to promote hidden escapes a little bit more. But then there are issues with that if hidden escapes don't have the infrastructure to be able to cope with it. So, you know, you could get places that get deluged. So it's going to be a fine balance, isn't there? I do think that people are going to want to get out into nature. There is going to be this desire to retreat to natural environments. But I'm also convinced that we will be flying in and out of cities because that's where most of the air routes will recover quickest. So there will be a degree of urban tourism as well. So I think we've got to look at that into the mix. That's got to kind of step up a little bit as well and look at how you can revitalize urban tourism around the region. And so it's not just shopping and it's not just, you know, the stuff that we did before. It's going to be tough. I think it's really going to be really, really tough to differentiate a destination because the lines, the sort of battle lines have been drawn, haven't they? Every country knows what they do best and has promoted it that way up to the point of the pandemic. Sort of switching tack is not always easy.
No, and, you know, as we keep saying, these big tourism boards as well, they have also a lot of legacy and it's quite hard, I think, to convince them to do something different or to change, especially right now. Maybe they want to kind of keep on those same old themes that they're familiar with, rather than perhaps going for something completely unknown in an unknown time as well.
I mean, one thing we've talked about on the pod quite a bit, Hannah, over the past few months was how destinations could really use some of the learnings they got from domestic travelers this year and, you know, promote some of the ways that domestic travelers have traveled, perhaps in ways they didn't do before. There may be some learnings there.
Definitely. So our wish for number seven is forgetting the idea that international tourists will undertake a 14-day quarantine on arrival to the country just for a holiday.
I sense you're going to rant here.
Yes. I mean, this is probably largely aimed at Thailand, I suppose, who, you know, pressed ahead with this special tourist visa idea last year. And they, in November, had a grand total of 3,065 international tourists. I'm not sure that all of those were even underneath this special tourist visa scheme. I think the majority perhaps weren't even. It's just kind of logical, isn't it, that you're really going to limit the number of people who will come to visit your country if you have to do a 14-day quarantine. And Thailand, towards the end of last year, you know, announced that they're going to open up visa-free access for, I think, 56 countries on arrival to Thailand. But the catch is they still have to undertake a 14-day quarantine. So, yes, they're open, but kind of open in name only, and that's just not going to work. Even for Singapore, they released the data this week that they had seven business lanes, reciprocal green lanes, set up, and between them being set up to the 26th of December, they had just about 2,500 business travellers. And this isn't even with quarantine. These business travellers don't have to undertake a quarantine, but they have to do quite rigorous tests and have to follow, you know, defined itineraries and things. Even that still managed to only trick 2,500.
It's a tricky issue. In a couple of countries, I think Thailand may be one, I think Malaysia is one. They were talking about reducing the quarantine time, weren't they, down to 10 days. But, you know, I'm not entirely sure whether that complies with scientific advice. But the problem with quarantines is it's the safety net. I mean, we've had a year now where governments have been incredibly cautious, incredibly worried about the spread of the virus through travel. And that two-week quarantine safety net, if it's managed properly, I mean, we've seen problems with the management in Australia. We've seen problems with the management of quarantines in other countries as well. But if it's managed properly, it is that safety net. But then you look at the other angle, and the Hong Kong-Singapore travel bubble was predicated on not having a quarantine. The Australia-New Zealand travel bubble initially was predicated on the same thing. At the moment, it's only one way from New Zealand to Australia. But I just don't see, until vaccines are rolled out, that governments are going to drop that requirement just because it's their safety net. It's the only thing that really protects them from huge criticism if things go wrong.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's just that what perhaps gets me is this pretense that they are open whilst having this quarantine. Say, we're open for tourists and trying to encourage the trade to engage with that. But of course, there's this limitation that people are not going to come in. So I think that I'd like to see this year governments getting realistic that, yes, OK, if we open to tourists under this condition, we might get some, but it's going to be on a really limited level and it's not going to help the tourism industry as a whole to recover.
Yeah, I mean, going back to your very first point, Hannah, point number one, when we were talking about volume setting, I mean, it could go the other way, couldn't it? We're actually setting quotas this year that actually governments and destinations will actually have maximum caps on the number of people that can come in, particularly for the first phases of reopening borders.
Yep. Yeah, I'm sure that we're going to see quotas imposed.
So number eight, moving through these quite quickly. This one's your point as well, Hannah. No more high-quality tourist talk from governments, but rather a recognition that mass travel also has a value. I think that's going to be so, so important.
Yeah, I mean, we have seen this mentioned by so many governments now, and they kind of code it. They say we want high-quality tourists, and what they really mean is high-spending tourists. And we've heard Thailand talk about this. I think we've had Malaysia talk about this more recently in their plans. And I'm all for it. I think that, yes, you do want high-quality tourists. You want tourists who are going to contribute to the whole of the ecosystem. But there is still value in mass tourism. And I think discounting that entirely is a massive disservice to all of those tourism stakeholders who rely on it, you know, down to the people who are doing food carts outside of a resort, or people giving massages on the beach in Thailand. All of these are all linked to the tourism industry and are linked to mass tourism as well. And when you start to just only talk about high quality tourists, you cut out a bunch of people's livelihoods. And actually, even Stuart MacDonald, and we interviewed him, when was it? Perhaps back in November last year, he raised the idea of backpacker tourism is really important in terms of contributing to the whole value chain of tourism as well. And so they shouldn't be overlooked. They're perhaps not high spenders, but where they do spend is more evenly distributed than perhaps high quality tourists who are just spending at high value, expensive hotels or resorts.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely right. I mean, when governments talk about high quality tourists, they tend to talk about short term stay, high spend. You're right. And you said that there's explosive spending power within a short period of time. As Stuart MacDonald pointed out, and so did Simon Westaway, said this, didn't he, from the Australian Tourism Industry Council. If you look at backpacker and budget travelers, they tend to spend longer in the country. So over a period of time, they do actually spend considerable amount of money. They also go to different destinations. You know, they travel around a country. They see quite a lot. They go into rural areas and small communities as well. So the money filters down. You know, the problem with backpacker travel at the moment is going to be the airfare prices. We're not quite sure what's going to happen with that. But, you know, mass travel has a huge value for airlines. If you didn't have mass travel, you know, companies like AirAsia would really, really struggle. So you're absolutely right. The whole value chain relies on travel being all things to everybody. And if you're only going to target high quality or whatever that means, because I still don't really know what that means. I guess that means luxury resort travelers primarily. You only really tap into part of the employment sector as well. You actually cut out, as you said, a lot of livelihoods and people who work in and around the visitor economy. But, you know, as we said just a minute ago there, if we're looking at caps on visitor arrivals for the foreseeable future, then I guess governments are going to want to maximize the revenue that they can make out of those limited numbers of travelers that will be coming in.
Yep, I think so. So number nine, and this came from me, I think, for 2021, is tourism stimulus packages that are including travel agents. So, I mean, perhaps partially biased because I'm from a travel agency background originally, but, you know, we have seen a lot of tourism stimulus packages being put together that are overlooking, I would say, travel agents. So, for example, in Singapore, you have the Singapore Rediscovers vouchers, these 100 Sing dollar vouchers that they've given to every Singaporean to spend. But it's pretty much cut out travel agents because you can only book it either online or you can book it via certain kiosks, which are, again, operated by the online travel players, but in a kind of offline format. So if you are a travel agent, yes, okay, you're perhaps luckier in Singapore because you do have quite substantial wage subsidies and things, but you're not going to generate any revenue from these vouchers that they are sending out to everybody. And the same in Thailand. They had this We Travel Together scheme, and it pretty much excludes travel agents from that as well. And, you know, travel agents are one in Southeast Asia, one of the backbones of the travel industry. Right now, they have extremely limited opportunities for revenue, especially when you consider domestic tourism. Generally, people are feeling a bit more confident to book by themselves. They're happier to book directly than perhaps through a middleman. So they have even more limited revenue. They've got no inbound tourism. They've got no outbound tourism. They're pretty much stuck.
You're the expert on travel agents, and I've got nothing else to say to that, Hannah. I think you said it absolutely perfectly clearly there. So this is 21 for 2021. This is our travel wish list for the year. We're running down from points number 1 to 11, and we've reached number 10, Hannah. And this one, the next two are both about international air travel, but the first one is about airlines getting the bailouts they need. And airlines have had big bailouts this year.
They have, but only in specific countries in Southeast Asia. So Indonesia, Garuda have had some money, Vietnam Airlines, Singapore Airlines. But there are some big countries where airlines have not had any cash yet from the government. So Thailand, I think the airlines asked for soft loans back in June, I think, and they were promised them back in June, and they've still had nothing. Of course, Thai Airways is now going through this rehabilitation process too, but there you've still got Thai Air Asia, you've still got Thai Lion Air, you've still got plenty of other domestic Thai airlines there that need help. Malaysia, again, none of the airlines, Air Asia, Malaysia Airlines, Malindo, have had any bailouts from the government. And in Malaysia, they're even talking about, they were shutting down Malaysia Airlines and making Firefly be the national flag carrier instead. And Philippines too. So Philippine Airlines has had to cut staff. It's not really had any bailout from the government yet. Cebu Pacific, nothing. Air Asia Philippines, nothing. So there have been some bailouts, but not everywhere. And it will be interesting to see what happens in 2021 if they don't get any more cash.
Yeah, absolutely. And the private bailouts, and we're still not quite sure what's happening with AirAsia. We're not sure where the funding that they're negotiating for is going to come from. Malaysia Airlines is an interesting case, as you mentioned there. You know, their subsidiary Firefly, there are still strong rumors that, you know, that will actually be rebuilt, as you said, for the national airline. I think there's some media talk today that the actual announcement on Malaysia Airlines restructure is due. It's going to be in the next few days or at least the next few weeks. We'll have a clearer picture there. But yeah, I mean, airlines are going to be slimmed down whatever funding they get, aren't they? So we're really looking at really difficult issues on the supply and the demand side for airlines. And, you know, we've got to hope that they pull through, because at the moment, even on domestic travel for the next quarter, the next two quarters, it's going to be very tough for them. They, you know, they have high costs, they burn cash. it's a difficult period when the uncertainty is so huge. And as I mentioned just a minute ago, you know, Qantas is saying that it's starting selling international flights from July. Well, if all other airlines have to do that, and they've got 7 months with precious little revenue, Qantas perhaps is slightly in a better position because it's got the domestic sector, which, although there are the border closures in Australia right now, if they are able to sort those out, at least it has a lifeline. But, you know, you look at countries, airlines like Singapore Airlines with no domestic travel, it's very, very difficult. They're going to be relying on cargo and vaccine logistics.
Yeah, I mean, in Southeast Asia, it's complicated because, yes, we've got the domestic tourism, so that has been supporting countries like Thailand. But now we're seeing these second, third waves hitting and getting a lot more serious in these countries. So I think at the beginning of December, Thai Air Asia was saying by the end of this year, we're going to have surpassed our 2019 domestic levels of flights. Well, I bet that didn't happen because domestic travel has ground to a halt pretty much in Thailand. And we are anticipating lockdowns happening again in Malaysia. Indonesia has imposed stricter controls. It's going to be a tricky first quarter.
Absolutely. Which brings us to our final point, number 11 for this show, Hannah. This is one of yours as well. Getting on an international flight once more. Tell us more.
Yeah, exactly. Well, do you know what? For me, it might be just getting on a flight at all, because I've not even been on a domestic flight. I've not flown since last February. So get any flight. That would be nice. But yes, wouldn't that be nice? I think that should be everybody's wish for 2021. Finally, getting to go on an international flight once more and going to a different country. And that would be an adventure in itself now, even if it's just to Singapore.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as you said, it's a tough year. We're not really sure when that's going to happen. I've been on a few domestic flights, and domestic flying is going to be very different to international flying. We know that, you know, the protocols are in place, you know, but you don't have the same, I think, fear factor. You're not going to have the same strict protocols and pre-flight testing that you're going to have for international flights for the foreseeable future. You know, even the WHO has said this week that it's possible that vaccinated travelers may still have to quarantine. We don't really know about the asymptomatic transmission, and we still don't know how vaccines are actually going to be used and how countries are going to mix and match them, or, you know, the actual scale of rolling out. There are so many issues to come there. But yeah, getting on a flight, going somewhere else, well, it seems like a distant lifestyle, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And that brings us to the end of part one of our 21 for 2021 Travel Wishlist show. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we said or what we missed out. You can email us at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full 2020 back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on, and this list keeps getting bigger and bigger, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app.
And that's a wrap for the first half of our first podcast of 2021. And we look forward to talking more Southeast Asia travel and tourism in part two of the show.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.